gentlemen, very much welcome indeed to our meeting this evening. Some of you may not be aware that since our last meeting three weeks ago roughly, we had a death, sudden death of one of our members. He just sat in the third row there, Father Gerard Laverty, who had come to Cushendall in the last few years and was very much loved by the parishioners and helped out Father Daly in the parish. He enjoyed the lecture. Many of you were speaking to him after it. I was indeed, and he was saying how much he enjoyed it. The following Sunday morning, he took the service in Cushendall and went home. And when Father Daly went up to the house afterwards, he found him dead. Terrible shock to everyone in the parish and Father Daly. We had the untimely death of the daughter-in-law of our founder member of her society, Frank Connolly. Now, Frank's daughter-in-law, Claire, died at the age of 36, after a fairly short illness. Frank, as I say, was the founder member of the society here and introduced me into the society here in the early days in the 1960s. So we'd like to offer our condolences to Father Brian Daly, and also to Frank, Nuala Connolly, and Paul Connolly. So, also, I'd just like you to know that we had a team in the quiz, the Ulster Federation. Let me get this right. It was the Federation of Ulster Studies, and it's held in Belfast Inst, and we had a very strong team there. They were actually leading up until the very end, and they finished third. You'd like to know, perhaps, that the team was Liz Hoy, Brian O'Hara, Harry Hume, Ivan Herbison, Frank Rogers, and Malachy McSparn. So I think they've been congratulated. They did us very proud indeed. Now, the main business of the meeting this evening, and there's an excellent attendance, and that, I'm sure, or something. The title of the talk this evening is Advance to Retreat, and our very learned speaker this evening is Mr. Gerard Muldoon, behind me here. Gerard, I'm blanking you off a bit. Gerard's main interest is in industrial archaeology. He is a self-employed accountant and very much specialises in business management. He lives in Newton Abbey, and of course many of you will know has been a regular contributor to the Glynn's magazine over the years. He's currently working on the Gasworks of Ireland and also the Bridges of Belfast, and we're looking forward very much to seeing the outcome of those studies. So I'd like you to welcome Mr. Gerard Muldoon.
Thanks very much. Thanks, Bob. Thanks very much indeed. Good evening, Reverend Fathers, ladies and gentlemen. I must say it's absolutely terrifying to see such a wonderful turnout. Thank you all for coming on a slightly inclement night. The subject is really one that centres on the Ballymena Cushendall and Redway Railway, but in addition to that takes in some of the local history, social history, and the general activity of transport in the area between 1870 and 1930. I suppose, in many respects, if one wanted to know how not to do a railway installation, this is probably a masterpiece in how not to do it. Typically, the low-lying areas around the province were chosen for the main lines because it was easy and relatively level, and laying track was comparatively straightforward. Here is one which is held the unique position of being the highest railway in Ireland, reaching over 1,000 feet. And the attendant difficulties associated with that will unfold as the evening passes, I hope. There are lots of interesting little snippets about this, and really I'm not an expert in anything, I'm just a curious passerby. And what I hope to present to you this evening are answers to some of the questions that I have asked. As far as the local knowledge is concerned, there are probably people in the audience who have forgot more than I'll ever know about it, but I hope you'll give me a buy in that, and I hope you find that some of the questions that I asked myself about this interesting phenomenon turn out to be interesting for you as well. In the early 1830s or thereabouts, there was an interest in iron ore in the region generally, which came and went. It was resurrected again in the 1860s, and the main purpose for the existence of the railway was the fact that iron ore needed to be moved very quickly from the high-lying land to the shore as quickly as possible. Come on in. The whole thing started off with this gentleman, William Valentine, who was one of the linen banking barons, capitalists in Belfast at the time. He moved out to what is now the Glenavna House Hotel in White Abbey. Gives his name to Valentine's Glen, which subsequently held one of the largest concrete constructions on the Belfast Northern Railway. And he, along with a few other pals, because they all kind of lived together, worked together, played together, and intermarried, decided that it would be a great idea to set up this railway running from Ballymena to Red Bay. The idea being that they would very quickly generate revenues from the transshipment of iron ore. When he started off, as I said earlier, the tendency had been to follow those areas which... we get it right yet? Nope. The low-lying areas are all crossed across... there. No? Yo! There he goes. Geography was not my strong point, as you may have gathered. You can see all of these lines here, which represent the low-lying areas, and that was the sensible place to put a railway down. These guys went off and did exactly the opposite and tried to put it into a situation which demanded near-impossible engineering. This, will be familiar to railway enthusiasts as a gradient profile. It shows the lie of the land, literally. And this is fairly horrendous stuff. The first plan was this one, which is very elaborate and dealt fairly intelligently with the engineering issues that arose from trying to get down the mountain. It turned out, of course, to be too expensive, and the directors went back to Mr. Lewis, the engineer, who's a pretty brilliant young engineer, and he came up with a second plan, which really was quite terrifying in its import. I have referred in other instances to a white knuckle ride, and the sort of gradient that that represented was certainly that. You can see from, if I can get this to work again, this is Dring in County Kerry, and you can see the gradient here is fairly extensive going right down. This represents about 20% of the gradient that was being proposed in that profile that I showed you, which was the second variation. White knuckle ride for any engine driver, it would certainly be absolutely terrifying. And in truth, I don't think anyone ever really believed that it was going to happen. And in the event, it didn't. So, with that in mind, and this was the proposal that they kicked off with, and they decided that they would... just turn that off for a second. Right. They decided that they would proceed anyway, and they engaged a man called Connor to construct the railway. He brought in several hundred navvies from Donegal and surrounding districts, and they set off to build the railway at about £5,000 a mile, which in those days was absolutely incredible pricing. There was a great deal of difficulty surrounding the acquisition of land. People who had odd scraps of land that was marshland and bogland, and as Dr. Patterson said, supported neither man nor beast, suddenly became very valuable. And there was a great deal of argument, discussion, wrangling went on. Eventually, a surveyor came and met in the Adair Arms and adjudicated on the value of land, which eventually allowed the railway to pass through. In the meantime, the ironworks were operating all the time. They were producing massive stockpiles of iron ore, which was not being moved away. They had previously carted iron ore, which you can see here, to the old Red Bay Harbour by horse and cart. And excuse me. That was a very, very, very slow process. The people in the mines, the mine owners, were dissatisfied with the rate at which material has been taken out. The alternative was to take the material to Ballymena, transfer it onto the Belfast Northern Counties line, and from there to Belfast, and from Belfast to ship it out to the West Coast. And that was ultimately what happened, and that was the real justification, so-called, for the line actually being developed. Right. Okay. You can see from when it moves forward. No, that's back chart. Sorry about this. This is not my equipment, so you'll excuse me not being in any way capable of operating it. It's going backwards. Sorry about this. Ah, now we're in business. Here's the type of... oh yeah, thanks. Good idea, thank you. This is the the difficulty that carters had to contend with, where in wintertime the roads were quagmire, and in summertime they were as hard as rock, both equally undesirable situations for transportation. So on the one hand you had the carters who were up against it in terms of maybe being able to take one load a day to the ships, and the owners building up tens of thousands of tons of iron ore straight out of the mines. It had to be resolved in some way, and the railway was the proposed solution. There was so much pressure on the railway to open that the contractor declared that in a few weeks' time the line would be open, and the siding that was necessary for the operating of that line hadn't even been built. So there's tremendous commercial pressure there. In the meantime, the iron ore markets were falling slightly, and so the pressure increased even more because it needed to be shipped out before the bottom fell out of the market. And eventually, the first 11 and 3/4 miles of the line were established and began to transfer material to Ballymena. The population in the area increased very dramatically because there were men brought in from Scotland and from North Umbria because they had iron ore mining experience. Those people were eventually replaced to some extent by the local population, and there are records of how well the local economy improved because these people had moved from farming and from land labouring to mining, and therefore generated higher incomes. My friend Dr. McCutcheon has remarked that looking at this photograph, you can see that there are a lot of boys there who are, as he says, aging before their time. Such was the difficulty of the work, the duration of the work. And remember, this is substantially pick and shovel work, and man propelled buggies to take the ore out of the mines. So it was far from a pleasant livelihood. There are a couple of other attempts at transportation in the area as well. The whole area became something of a kind of an El Dorado for iron ore, and everyone who has anyone who had any money to invest had attempted to get some profit from the extraction of material in the area. This was the famous piece of line that ended up being stolen, and it ran to the pier at Carrie Murphy, just at Waterfoot there, instead of going to Red Bay, which would have been the logical thing to do. It was politically inappropriate for that company to attempt to take the line. to Red Bay because they would have to have traversed the intended Ballymena Cushnadall line, and that was never going to work. This worked moderately well for a period of time. It had the advantage of deep water, and it also had the disadvantage of being exposed to what seemed to be a frequent number of storms, and eventually the wooden top, there was a concrete base and a wooden top, and the wooden top succumbed to the ravages of sea and wind. And I think if you're engaged in scuba diving, you might still see some of the concrete bases. Here was another attempt, and this photograph is in the public domain almost entirely due to the efforts of members of the society. It appeared in, I think it was volume 8 or 10 of the Glynns originally. I managed to acquire a legitimate copy, which is reproduced here. And this was an overhead cable system which ran down to the coast. There's a story relating to how it ended up rather poorly, as it happens, because it was sabotaged. And unfortunately, it was sabotaged after the Ballymena Cushnadall and Red Bay directors had invested some money in acquiring it. But that's what happened. So the alternatives in terms of the shipping to Carrick Murphy and the overhead cable both failed. So at this stage, the opportunities to bring material to this coastline were pretty much written off. When the line was eventually opened, they acquired two of their three locomotives. For railway enthusiasts, these were 042 saddle tank engines, and they cost £1,472 each. The first two came online and operated reasonably successfully. They also had cast iron wheeled wagons, which proved inadequate for the task and had to be replaced by steel wagons. The directors had involved themselves in something of a sleight of hand in accounting terms, I think it might be said. There was some creative accounting took place whereby the directors did a deal with a finance company, a hire purchase company, so that the hire purchase company would not put their names on the wagons as they were legally entitled to do, because the directors wanted to create the impression that the company owned the wagons when in fact the hire purchase company were the legal owners. They were trying to boost investor confidence because they still needed funding for the second half of the project to take the line the next 5¾ miles to retreat, and they didn't quite succeed in doing that in terms of generating investor confidence. One of the people who was involved in driving the trains was a chap who was pretty much a legend in his own lifetime. He's in the picture there to the right, and he's called Roddy Miller. Most of these people claimed ownership of their locomotives. They ran them as though they were their own. And there's a story which Dr. Patterson tells about Roddy Miller coming in on Sunday morning to supervise, some might say, assist with the cleaning of the engines. And when we talk about cleaning, they were scrubbed clean, they were polished, they were shining bright. And one of the things that they did for some reason was to half fill the tank with water and fire it up and put potatoes into the tank to absorb limescale. And apparently it was not unknown for some of Roddy's colleagues to nip around when Roddy was doing something else and grab a few boiled potatoes for an early Sunday morning breakfast. But the truth of that I don't know about, but it's a nice story anyway. Roddy would then be back on Monday morning to take the 7:35 out of Parkmore. So that with that sort of dedication from a small number of employees, it was not surprising that when the company started off operating, it was working very successfully. It started off shipping iron ore at two shillings five and three quarters pennies. It's about 12p in modern money, to 3 farthings, 53 farthings, that's it, a ton, which was really quite a colossal income for such a small and inexperienced organisation. And it was remarked by a number of the railway commentators at the time that this was an outstanding level of revenue, and so the company was expected to succeed. That did lift investor confidence for a time, and so they were able to continue with the second phase of the development, where they were this time working over much more difficult terrain with a cost of £2,000 per mile. Obviously the directors had been sharpened up in terms of what they had laid out initially to build the line, and the costing was assisted by the fact that they were able to use part of an old road for the track bed, and that saved a great deal of cost. They eventually got to retreat, and when they did, everyone really had to hold their hands up to say, look, we're not taking this any further, this is as far as we go. And so the advance to retreat was complete. The line operated very successfully, supplying transit for a number of different mining companies who all had various types of linkage. There were tramways, there were cableways, there were inclined planes, there were some locomotive drawn lines as well, all feeding this arterial route from Retreat to Ballymena. When the materials got to Ballymena, the Cushendall Company had very cleverly arranged its own series of gantries, whereby the narrow gauge wagons that belonged to them were come in at a higher level, and underneath that there were broad gauge wagons also owned by Ballymena, Cushendall and Red Bay, which were then taken on the Belfast Northern Counties line to Belfast. And it's also reported that there was some skullduggery went on because the marshalling yards in Belfast would often hold on to Cushendall's broad gauge wagons until such times as they were unable to fill them back at Ballymena, and had to make special arrangements to have a consignment of broad gauge wagons brought late at night, which obviously increased the cost of so doing. So there was a lot of sort of unofficial competition took place in terms of actually getting that job done.
Okay.
Let's see where we are now. As I said, the original lines, there was an awful lot of parsimony in the original development. That, you know, they'd gone for cast iron 45-pound rails, which were cheap and nasty and ultimately had to be replaced. They had used locally grown larch for sleepers instead of imported red pine. They had the deal with the hire purchase company for cheap wagons that ultimately didn't do the job and had to be replaced. And when they were replaced, they were replaced with these. And there is actually somewhere out to the west of the province, there is the chassis of one of these things left. I'm still trying to find it, but it shows you that, you know, it's an antique in railway terms, and when I get it, I'm sure there'll be a wee story about it. Okay, let's see where we are now. Ultimately, the decline in freight led to the development of the application of the company, which had now been taken over by Northern Counties, to carry passengers as well as freight. And you can see here, when I move out of the way, let me get out of the way here altogether, you can see here that this is the old Parkmore station. That's the station master's house in the back, and that is an open veranda mixed train which operated between the three times a day between Retreat and Ballymena. The mixed passenger and freight combination meant that the trains were quite slow and fairly unpredictable in their timetabling, because it really depended on what was being unloaded or loaded as to how long the train stayed in a particular station. And eventually this became a source of dissatisfaction for the travelling public, such as they were. Here is an improvement of the whole thing when the operation became more focused on tourism. and they had a better class of carriage to accommodate the tourist trade. You can see this operates this train is operating exclusively for passenger service, and the idea of mixing had become less favourable an idea. Here again is more of the passenger traffic. You can see that there are other people daring to look out of the carriages, because that stage at a maximum speed of 25 miles an hour. People thought if you went faster than that, you'd probably self-destruct. But that was the mode of accommodation that suited tourists at the time, and it worked very successfully for the time that it lasted. Again, more of the rolling stock that was used at the time. The tourists had an option when they went for these tours. They could do the long route, which meant that they left Belfast at 6 o'clock in the morning and travelled on the Belfast Northern Counties to Ballymena, and then took the Ballymena to Parkmore train, and they could spend 4 or 5 hours in the glens, viewing the glens and its amenities. Alternatively, they could take the short route, which was to take the broad gauge line to Larne and travel from Larne on, that's the coast road, believe it or not, to Parkmore and view the grounds, and then go back to Ballymena on the evening train, which meant that they had 2 or 3 hours to spend in the glens at that time, enjoying all of the walks, which had been actually built and made up by the Belfast Northern Counties Company for the benefit of tourists. These were some of the amenities that were provided. They had the Shelley type tea rooms for tourists, so the people obviously who were taking the long tour had a reasonable amount of time to spend enjoying the walks and enjoying the facilities that were here. They also had built here a photographic darkroom, because photographers of the time had a wet plate process, and those great big cameras that you see in the old films with the hood that went over their heads and all that sort of stuff. And to make sure that they had recorded some good pictures of their day out, they went down to the darkroom and developed the plates to make sure they were okay. And if they found out the plates weren't okay, they scurried back up the glen and took another shot to make sure they were going home with nice plates to show all the folks back home. And that was another thing that was developed there. And it was very, very successful and did a vast amount of business. I would love to see some of the plates. On the way back, taking the early morning route, they came back by car. And a favourite stop off was at the... Sorry? Who said that? Thank you. Okay, been here before. This was very much how the place looked. I don't know how clear it is. This is a stuffed dog, and it's rumoured that it was her ladyship's dog, and it stayed in the house long after everyone else was gone. So it was great to get in here and look around and see how the gentry lived and all the rest of it, and it was a very, very popular location for people coming from Belfast. You could have a cup of tea there as well too. I have this back in again because I just wanted to point out the Belfast roof construction for the old Parkmore station. This was destroyed in 1922, unfortunately, because it was rather a special piece of construction, and was ultimately replaced by the concrete construction of the type that still remains there. Somewhere in all of these transparencies, there's a photograph of an alien at Parkmore. Nope, that's not him. There he is. How am I going to get this stopped? There it is. That's it. Isn't it? No, it's not. Turn it off. Is that you?
Yeah, that's it.
Okay. Having been soaked for the third time that day, I was taking shelter in the old station. This is important, one, because it represents the archaeology of the time, but it was important from the point of view that in replacing the station, the Belfast Northern Counties had begun to experiment very successfully with concrete casting construction. And they started off with, I don't know if you remember the old bus stops, concrete bus stops. Do anyone remember those? That was one of the early experiments. They started off, they had rail posts, and eventually they got up into bigger and bigger buildings. And you can see that this one has stood the test of time. It was, as most people probably know, a number of things, including a youth hostel, but the essential structure is still there. Okay. Got this upside down there. Again, that's another one of the same. This represented some innovations in concrete structure. It's important from an industrial archaeology point of view. You can see it's dated 1913, which makes it one of the largest concrete structures of its type for that date. The experimentation had begun in 1911. Now, concrete existed long before that. The Romans had a form of concrete, but its use in adding architectural features, if you could call it that, to buildings was the innovative use, and the getting to a second level with the use of reinforced concrete was a further innovation that they had developed. And they had a great deal of success, which probably culminates with the viaduct in Valentine's Glen, which had a massive structure and still stands today, and is still highly regarded today for what it is in railway engineering. That, unfortunately, is no longer with us, and I put it in because it's a past artifact. That was the miners' cottages in Parkmore, and it was a tremendous shame. It was entirely unnecessary that it should have been destroyed, but it was. And I mean, there was no development of the land, as you know. The pile of bricks just lay there, and grass grew over it, and that was basically it. So, it was. I mean, if today the Ulster Architectural Heritage Society were up there with all the troops surrounding the place and saying, "You're not doing it," quite rightly so, but that didn't work then. Again, there's the engine. This was the second engine that they had, and they made the mistake of developing the tanks forward to cover the smoke box. It was rebuilt in Belfast, and it turned out to be an engineering disaster of the first order, and 102 was the first train to be scrapped. Alongside of that, they were also working on an early type of containerization. You can see this took place in Ballyclare, and the big gantry enabled these pre-constructed trucks to be lifted off, loaded directly onto the motor vehicle, the motor lorry, steam lorry. And again, I just included that because it was an association that came from the general narrow gauge railway development in the area, was a partially successful attempt at early containerization. Okay, I have talked far too long. I don't know if anyone saw the introduction to the session. There was a film made by Richard Jolly about 4 years ago, where they spoke to one of the people who had actually worked on the Ballymena Cushion Don Red Bay Railway, a man called Jimmy Downey. And unfortunately, Jimmy missed his 100th birthday by about 2.5 weeks, I think. Sadly, no longer with us, but his story very much is. And Richard Jolly produced, I think, about 7.5 hours of material. The good news is that I got 20 minutes of it, and that's all we're seeing tonight. But it's a lovely indication of somebody who worked on the railway at that time and the things that took place. And I would like to see the video now, if someone can get it going for me. Technically, is it set? Do you know? Switch it on. Yeah, I know. That much I can do. Which is where, okay. Okay. Just just leave you to enjoy this. Can we increase the volume there at all?
Up here, the place was covered with snow. It wasn't very, very pleasant. I think it had been cut off lots of times before because I heard the men talking about it. But I don't know anything about that. I only can tell you what I saw. I never saw anything like that. There was one snowstorm, I think it was around about 1916. I think it blocked the place up here. Well, I wasn't coming up here at that time. But I remember the road was blocked anyway for a couple of days. They got it cleared up. This place here, this was where the wagons come down here, at this platform, where they take the stuff out of them. They got emptied here. And the man wheeled them out from the cart, out of the wagons, onto it. And loaded them on his cart for Cushion Dillon. Well, then when they were emptied, they were pushed on down a bit. There were plenty of room back down there. And then the full loaded ones come down. They brought down a wagon at a time and emptied it. And I think there was a good shed down there, further down there, where they could have stuff it. If they weren't able to cart down, they could have painted it up in the shed, you know, and kept it in good order. But this is where they took it out of the wagons here. And the man, he has carts here, and he carted it down then.